Still to come on the programme between now and 9 o'clock, live from Melbourne, we'll have the latest on the sentencing of the man who's pleaded guilty to the murder of Louth woman Jill Marr. He has a degree of depravity rarely seen, the court heard today. Minister Leo Varadkar will be live in studio on giving air passengers more rights and breaking the link between alcohol sponsorship and sport. The Law Reform Commission reports today on sentencing and has a range of changes it wants to see. From Galway, we'll be speaking to the Commission's Tom O'Malley. Research published in a medical journal has indicated cancer screening programmes have yet to show a reduction in women who die from the disease. We'll be hearing from a consultant on the questions now being raised. And we've a report from a blind soccer tournament which took place in recent days.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 11th of June on RTÉ Radio 1. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Fran McNulty and Cathal McCullough.
The headlines. An Australian court has heard that the man who raped and murdered Irishwoman Jill Marr in Melbourne last year was a violent sexual offender who was out on parole and on bail at the time of the attack. The Law Reform Commission has recommended that current minimum sentences for certain drugs offences should be repealed because traffickers have adapted by using expendable couriers. And Turkish riot police entered Istanbul's Taksim Square this morning using water cannon and tear gas to try and disperse protesters. The news in full now from Brian Jennings.
The man who raped and murdered Irishwoman Jill Marr in Melbourne last year was described at his sentence hearing today as a violent sexual offender with a likelihood to re-offend. 41-year-old Adrian Bailey has previously pleaded guilty to raping and murdering the County Louth woman last September as she walked home from a nearby bar. Today, her husband, family and friends described to the Supreme Court of Victoria the impact her killing had had on them. From Melbourne, Katrina Perry reports.
The Supreme Court of Victoria heard today that Adrian Bailey has been charged with rape before, when he was 18, then 29, and now at 41. At the time he raped and murdered Jill Marr in Brunswick last September, he was out on parole, released 3 years early from a sentence for raping five women. He was also on bail for an assault charge pending appeal. He was described in court as having a degree of sexual depravity rarely seen in Australia. His barrister told the court that Bailey said he was sorry for what he had done and was seeking a life sentence, but without a mandatory minimum duration. Breaking down as he delivered his victim impact statement, Jill's father, George McKeown, spoke of how her killing had destroyed the family and stolen her future. The court heard how her husband, Tom, is haunted by what happened, wishing he could have told her he loved her in her final moments. He said he suffers anxiety and panic attacks now and is only half a person without his wife, who he described as having a beautiful mind and a brilliant soul. Mr. Justice Geoffrey Nettle will hand down a sentence next Wednesday. Katrina Perry, RTÉ News, Melbourne.
The Law Reform Commission has recommended that the mandatory life sentence for murder should be retained, but that judges should be allowed to recommend a specific minimum term. In a report on mandatory sentencing today, the Commission also recommends that the current minimum sentences for certain drugs and firearms offences should be repealed. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
The mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years in prison for those caught with more than €13,000 worth of drugs was introduced in 1999 because of the public outrage over the activities of drug dealers following the murder of the journalist Veronica Guerin. But the Law Reform Commission now says it should be repealed because the traffickers have adapted to it by using expendable couriers, and it's these relatively low-level offenders rather than those at the top who are being jailed. The high level of guilty pleas in order to avoid the 10-year sentence has also increased the number of low-level drug offenders in the prisons, and the Commission recommends that a more structured, guidance-based sentencing system would provide an appropriate alternative. The only completely mandatory sentence in Ireland is the life sentence for murder, and while the Commission recommends this be maintained, it also says judges should have the power, as in Northern Ireland, to recommend a minimum term a convicted murderer should spend in prison. The Commission also recommends that a judicial council should be able to develop and publish suitable guidance or guidelines on sentencing, and welcomes the government's proposal to establish the parole board on an independent statutory basis.
Hundreds of Turkish riot police have entered Istanbul's Taksim Square this morning, using water cannon and tear gas to try and disperse protesters who've been staging demonstrations against plans to redevelop an adjoining park. Reports say groups of demonstrators threw petrol bombs, stones and other missiles at police. Earlier, it was announced that the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has agreed to meet leaders of the movement whose initially peaceful protests in the city led to a series of anti-government demonstrations across the country. Announcing tomorrow's meeting, the Deputy Prime Minister Bülent Arınç did not adopt a conciliatory tone.
Illegal demonstrations will no longer be permitted in Turkey, and whatever needs to be done according to the law will be done. Illegal demonstrations will no longer be tolerated.
The State Examinations Commission has been criticised for making several errors in setting the Leaving Certificate maths papers. Yesterday it emerged that there was a mistake in the trigonometry section of the higher level paper. But on this programme, Catherine Lewis, a member of the National Council of Maths Teachers, has said there were several mistakes across papers taken in the new maths syllabus at all levels.
I have never in 20 years of going to these meetings have so many errors come up. You know, there are a lot of small errors. It would seem to me if I were doing this at a level at school and I'd produced a paper like this, it would be because I was in a rush.
Air traffic controllers in France are staging a three-day strike to protest against EU plans to create a single European airspace. The controllers say the single European sky project will affect public safety and their working conditions. Aer Lingus and Ryanair have had to cancel a number of flights to and from France today. Intending passengers are advised to check their airline's website for details. Nelson Mandela is spending a fourth day in a Pretoria hospital where he's being treated for a recurring lung infection. The office of President Jacob Zuma says the 94-year-old remains in a serious but stable condition. Relatives of the former South African president, including his ex-wife Winnie, was among the few people allowed to visit him yesterday. Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past eight.
9 minutes after 8 o'clock, and Deirdre Purcell is here again to tell us what it says in today's papers.
Eric Luke's picture of a huge placard, complete with skull and crossbones and emblazoned with the words "No to giant sewage plant," creates the headline for this morning's main story on the front page of the Irish Times. The site for this plant was announced yesterday as Clonshach, 2 kilometres from Dublin Airport, and has ignited strong local protests. The Irish Examiner leads with its report on the recommendations of the Law Reform Commission that, as you've heard in the bulletin, recommends changes in some mandatory sentencing. The lead in the Irish Independent expands somewhat on yesterday's story concerning TD John McGuinness, in that we're told that there is growing pressure on him to step down from his chairmanship of the Public Accounts Committee. The lead story in the Irish Daily Mail concerns Tom Curran, partner of Mary Fleming, the woman who has so far failed in her court bids to enable him, when the time comes, legally to assist her to end her own life. Mr. Curran told the paper he has received advice from the head of the suicide information group Exit International. On an inside page of the Times, the paper's Joe Humphreys is reporting on a speech given by Professor Tom Collins, a former head of the Royal College of Surgeons Ireland campus in Bahrain. The RCSI here has been the focus of media criticism for its stance when some of its Bahraini students were arrested and detained during protests in that country. But Professor Collins, who was addressing a conference on ethics in education, said that while the focus was on the RCSI, other universities in this country had questions to answer about their relationships with non-democratic countries, which had been criticised by, for instance, Amnesty International. It can be difficult, he said, to reconcile being a critic with being an enterprise. So what else? The Road Safety Authority has recommended an independent investigation into the controversy about penalty points being wiped. Its chairman, Gabe Byrne, said his board was unhappy with the findings of the internal Gorda review. That's in The Independent. The Times, along with most other papers, runs a feature on Edward Snowden, the whistleblower who has exposed the cyber surveillance of internet communications. He doesn't want to be the story, he says, and has checked out from his Hong Kong hotel. Seeking asylum now, according to some versions of this continuing story, for instance in The Independent, where John Swain, writing from New York, tells us that Mr. Snowden has said, "The only thing I can do is to sit here and hope the Hong Kong government does not deport me." And from the good news filings, The second paragraph of the lead story in today's farming supplement for The Independent reads as follows. Superb weather conditions and near record milk prices have ratcheted up milk supplies at all the co-ops. But such a silver lining has its attendant cloud. There are now fears that Ireland could incur a super levy fine for exceeding its national milk quota. But the happy news does continue. Things looking better for sheep, writes John Shirley, and from Dara McCullough, all future beef requirements will be sourced from Irish and British farms by the frozen food giant Birdseye. And now five stories common to most of the papers today. Firstly, we're told that Chris Hadfield, the Canadian commander of the International Space Station, has retired. Secondly, a dog called Luca was rescued by the RNLI, having fallen 200 feet down a cliff face in Howth, County Dublin. Two women repelled would-be masked and armed robbers in a chip shop in Balbriggan by pelting them with salt cellars and vinegar bottles. Offaly hurlers may have lost their match with Kilkenny over the weekend, but they have secured a world record, with, we're told, former county stars pitching in aid of Irish autism action. And the world record in question? For making ham sandwiches, 3,140 of them in 37 minutes. And finally, Cork Airport was evacuated yesterday when two fire alarms sounded, triggering a mandatory response. The cause? In the staff canteen, a customs official burned his toast.
Morning, Ireland. 14 minutes after 8 o'clock will we begin this hour in Melbourne. As you've been hearing on our news bulletins this morning, the husband, family and friends of Jill Marr have been telling the Supreme Court in Melbourne the devastating impact her murder and rape have had on them. The 29-year-old was attacked and murdered last September when walking home from a bar in the city. The man accused of the crime, Adrian Bailey, has pleaded guilty to the rape and murder. The court was told today he had previously raped 21 times, the first time when he was just 18 years of age. RT's Katrina Perry is in Melbourne and joins us now. Katrina, what more did we learn about, or what now do we know about the night that Jill Marr disappeared?
Well, the case this morning started out with the barrister for the Crown, essentially the DPP here, just going back over the facts of that night of the 22nd of September 2012. CCTV footage, about 5 minutes of it, was played to the court, which listeners are probably quite familiar with at this stage, of the pictures of Jill walking home from a bar where she'd been with a friend in the early hours of the morning. What we learned what happened at that night was when she had left work, she went for a drink with a work friend. They then went on to a birthday party, and a gang of them headed back to where she lived in Brunswick, where they went to two more bars, and then she parted company with one friend who offered to walk her home, but she declined as she lived just 5 minutes away. And it was at this point that she encountered Adrian Bailey, who had been put out of a taxi by a driver who feared he wouldn't pay his fare further down the road, and he was then seen sprinting along in the direction of Jill Marr. He approached her, she rebuffed him, there was a bit of an altercation, he went away and he came back aggravated, and it was at that point then that we heard he had dragged her off the main street and onto a little side road laneway where he raped her. Then she fought back and threatened to call the police, at which point there was a bit of a tussle. It was described in court that Jill had fight in her, and as she was entitled to, she was putting up a bit of a fight, and after this tussle then Adrian Bailey strangled her and killed her.
What more did we learn about Mr. Bailey? Some of what you've been reporting on the bulletins will have shocked some people.
Absolutely. Quite a lot was revealed about Adrian Bailey's background and, I suppose, his history today. He was described as a very serious, violent sexual offender. We heard that he has raped over 20 times in the past. The first time when he was just 18 years of age, again when he was 29, and this instance with Jill when he was 40, 41. The shocking thing, I suppose, for most people will be to learn that at the time at which he attacked Jill, he was actually on parole, where he had been convicted in 2002 of 16 rape counts against five women and sentenced to quite a lengthy sentence in prison. Now, he was released on St. Patrick's Day last year when he still had 3 years left to serve on that sentence, but for good behaviour and whatever else, he was released from prison. So he was on parole essentially when he attacked Jill. He was also on bail at the time, as in the meantime he had been convicted of an assault charge and been released on bail pending. So there were two, I suppose, reasons there that perhaps he shouldn't have been where he was at the time. The court also heard today that despite originally lying to police when he was arrested about his involvement in all of this, he did later accept what he had done. And his barrister said today that he was remorseful for what he had done to Jill and what he had put her family and friends through. He wrote a note which was read to the court by his barrister, and in that he said he was sorry for what he had done. He said he couldn't imagine what her family and friends were going through. He said he wasn't seeking forgiveness, but he just wanted to say sorry for what he had done because he was truly sorry. The court also heard from a psychologist, a Professor James Ogloff, who had carried out an extensive psychological evaluation of Adrian Bailey. He was in prison custody following this attack, and he described him as a violent sexual offender. He said he had a degree of sexual depravity that was rarely seen in the Australian. A borderline personality disorder.
We appear to be having.
He said there was evidence that he had been physically and.
My apologies, Katrina. We're having some problems with your link to Melbourne, and we may well come back to you later in the programme. But the time now, 19 minutes after 8.
We're going to something which we mentioned yesterday. This is a meeting of European Transport Ministers to discuss an improving or a strengthening of air passengers' rights. Now, we're only at the start of a negotiation process, but nevertheless, some significant rights, as we briefly mentioned yesterday, are in the offing or under discussion. We're joined by the Transport, Tourism and Sports Minister, Leo Varadkar, who chaired that discussion in Brussels yesterday. Minister, good morning.
Morning.
And welcome. Significantly, what's on the table?
We had a very busy day in Luxembourg yesterday. About five new European laws were agreed in aviation, road safety, railway interoperability, and also marine equipment. What we also did was launch the first reading, if you like, the initial debate on a new package of air passenger rights. The existing law is there since 2004, but it's shown a number of deficiencies. A lot of passengers are having difficulty getting their rights vindicated. And as well as that, new issues have come up, particularly after the volcanic eruption, and issues as to who really should bear the cost of that. So very briefly, the new proposals, what they involve is proper rights to information. Passengers will be allowed to give, will have to get full information after 30 minutes as to whether their flight is going to be delayed or cancelled. There'll be a right to compensation after 5 hours for a short-haul flight and after 9 hours for a long-haul flight. There'll be a new provision for delays on the tarmac, and you'll probably experience it yourself, and it's one of the most frustrating delays when you're actually on the plane and stuck there and you're on the tarmac, and there'll be a right to things like refreshments and water after an hour, air conditioning, toilets if needs be. Also, there'll be the issue of no-shows. So if somebody has a return flight and for some reason they miss the outbound portion of that flight, the airline can't assume that they're not going to get on the return flight. At the moment, they can assume that. And then there's a couple of little things as well around carrying musical instruments on board and so on.
Have you or will you be discussing this with the airline executives?
Yeah, well, of course, there's what's normal in all of these areas is a public consultation. We've done an initial one already, and there actually were very few inputs to that. One thing the airlines have the most concerns about relates to interlining and missed connections and so on. And they also rightly point out that when acts of God occur, for example, like a volcanic eruption, that they alone shouldn't have to bear the cost of that. I think they have a point there.
Yeah, and the other thing which I could just imagine Michael O'Leary saying, you know this before you talk to him, there is no such thing as a return flight on Ryanair. Therefore, in their view, therefore, return flight rights don't arise.
Yeah, I don't know if he would say that. There's certainly no.
Well, they always tell you that when you book a ticket.
Yeah, well, there's definitely no connecting flights with Ryanair. But if you actually go on their website, you click either the one way box or the return box. So if they have that on their website, well, there must be return flights. One thing as well that's going to happen under this law as well is there'll be much clearer procedures as to how passengers can have their rights vindicated. So if they do make a complaint to an airline, they have to have that acknowledged within a week and reply to substantively within 2 months. And that hasn't always happened to date.
How long is this going to take?
Well, this is only a first reading, so the Council, which is the governments, have to agree our version. The European Parliament will have to agree their version, and then we'll have to discuss and compromise on it. So I'd say it could be really a year to 18 months before it comes into effect.
On a separate matter, a number of developments reported on by the Irish Independent this morning. First of all, that the Road Safety Authority is looking for an independent investigation into the penalty points controversy, making it clear they're not satisfied with the investigation, or they don't feel the investigation carried out so far is enough. And secondly, telling us that you've actually met one of the whistleblowers. Do you think this needs more investigation?
I suppose I come at this from a road safety point of view. Garda matters are a matter for Mr. Shatter, and I don't want to intrude on his area of responsibility. What he has asked me to do after the report was published, he asked that my department and the RSA study that report and then write back to him with our suggestions, our reflections on the report and our suggestions as to what should be done. And that process is now underway, but the RSA have now given me their views, and their view is that this requires a further investigation. They're suggesting that the Garda Ombudsman Commission should investigate at this stage.
What do you think?
I think they're probably right. The Gardaí have taken this seriously. There wouldn't be disciplinary action if they hadn't taken it seriously, and they have proposed some new procedures to tighten up the system. But reading through the report, I have to say that, particularly reading the appendixes in the different cases, I have to say that I got the sense, not so much that they'd looked at the underbelly of this, but that in a lot of cases they were explaining away penalty point terminations that to the reasonable person seemed a little bit unusual. And the RSA is now proposing that there be a further investigation by the Garda Ombudsman Commission. I think that's a good suggestion.
In terms of public confidence?
I think it's very important that the public does have confidence in the penalty point system. You know, the law needs to be enforced, and it needs to be enforced in the same way on everyone. And if there is discretion, then discretion should apply equally to everyone. And there is a sense among the public that maybe that's not the case. And I have new legislation coming forward later in the year to tighten the penalty point system. And, for example, to bring in the graduated license system like they have in the UK, where a learner driver or a novice driver would lose their license after 6 penalty points. And it's very hard to bring in those kind of new measures if people don't have confidence that the system is working and that it's fair and it's being applied equally to everyone.
Do you expect this to happen? I mean, the Road Safety Authority want it. You think it's a good idea. Do you expect and hope that it will happen?
Well, ultimately, it's not a matter for me. It's also gone to the Oireachtas Committee. The Joint Oireachtas Committee are considering this too, and I understand they have a similar impression that they may either hold hearings themselves or they may ask another competent body to look at the report.
And the Ombudsman Commission, that's what it's there for.
It is, but I'm actually not 100% sure whether it falls under their remit or not, and that's something that has to be, that still has to be clarified.
You met the whistleblower whose information sparked all these concerns. Your impressions?
There are a number of whistleblowers, in fact, but I did meet one of them at his request. I didn't do so until the report was published. I didn't think it was appropriate to do so before then. I thought it was a very useful meeting. It was very interesting. I thought he was very credible. And I have to say, a lot of what was in his original dossier and a lot of what he said to me has turned out to be accurate. Maybe not 100% of it, but certainly 80%. And that's why I think it's important that we listen to whistleblowers and that they're protected.
All right, two other matters. One in relation to the business that the Cabinet has to make its mind on, but you have a direct interest in and responsibility for. Alcohol sponsorship. Is it your view that effectively this needs to be parked? It's not on the cards now. A ban on alcohol sponsorship of sports events?
No, I wouldn't say that. My major concern in relation to this, of course, is the funding for sport be maintained. That's my interest with being the minister responsible for sport. I do think that we have a problem in Ireland with binge drinking and chronic alcohol consumption, notwithstanding the fact that alcohol consumption in Ireland is actually falling and public order offences are falling, and indeed the number of young people who have experimented alcohol is actually falling. In contrast to France, for example, where they do have a ban on sponsorship, where it's increasing, and that's based on research published by the Department of Children and Youth Affairs. But I do think that we do need to have a package of measures to help Ireland address its bad relationship with alcohol.
Does that mean
that has to include a lot of things, you know?
Yeah.
And I think one of the sad things about this is that it's all become about this one aspect of what is actually a very good package.
In relation to your responsibilities, are you saying that maybe we should have a bit of a ban?
Well, I understand that's the proposal at the moment, is to have a ban on sporting events, but not on culture events for some reason, which I don't fully understand. And I'd be interested to hear from the Department of Health as to what their rationale is behind that. But I think what we need is a package of measures. One thing I very strongly support, for example, is minimum pricing. Alcohol is too cheap in Ireland, and people therefore buy too much of it. Again, and the second thing, which again I think has not been taken enough attention to, is the whole issue of enforcement. You know, if I go to America, if you go to America, you have to produce an ID.
But again,
that doesn't
happen. To drag it back to your responsibilities, in effect, are we talking about a can that's going to be kicked down the road? Certainly, as we've heard in the last couple of days, past the point, or in other words, that nothing will be done too early to disrupt, for example, the holding of the Rugby World Cup if it happens in Ireland, that nothing will be done before 2024.
Yeah, well, like I say, when it comes to the sports sponsorship issue, which is only one small aspect of this package, my key concern, number one, is to ensure that funding for sport is protected. Tens of millions of euro come into sport from the drinks industry, whether we like it or not, and that goes down to the local level and benefits physical activity. So I want to see that protected. And the second issue is I don't want to see Ireland excluded from international competitions. If other countries aren't going down this route, I don't want to see us losing out.
All right, just on general politics, Micheál Martin has backed John McGuinness as chairperson of the Public Accounts Committee, while saying he was expressing a personal view in relation to whether spouses' trips should be paid for, but effectively saying that as chairman of the committee, nobody is saying he's failed in any way. Would you accept the point?
I have to say I've a lot of time for John McGuinness personally. He's an outspoken politician, and he's very serious about what he does, and I know he works very hard. I think the difficulty for him at this stage, though, is that he spent a long time, a number of years now, giving out about wasteful expenditure and giving out about excessive use of public expenditure. And that's why he was appointed as chairman of the PAC by Micheál Martin. And the revelations in recent weeks do certainly raise credibility questions for him. But he was appointed to that position, or at least nominated to that position, by Micheál Martin. There's a lot of talk in the last couple of weeks about the government controlling the Dáil. This is an example of
Should
where
he
we
resign?
Don't. In the first instance, I think that's a matter really for Micheál Martin to decide, and also the members of the PAC who elected him as their chairman, albeit on the nomination of Micheál Martin.
Is his credibility at issue, and therefore the committee's credibility? Therefore, should he consider his position?
I think his credibility is at issue, but I know enough about stories that appear in the press to know that often all the facts aren't there, and I think he has the right to, at the very least, account for himself before the Public Accounts Committee and to explain to members his version of events.
Minister Leo Varadkar, thank you very much. 8:30.
We're going back to Melbourne for the sentencing of the man pleading guilty to the rape and murder of Jill Maher is taking place. RT's Katrina Perry is there. Katrina, you were telling us earlier about the background to the case, but also today we heard some victim impact statements from Jill Maher's family. What did you hear in court?
So six victim impact statements were delivered today. Her husband, Tom Maher, was in the courthouse, but he left the main body of the court just before proceedings began, and lawyers for the Crown Prosecution read his statement into evidence. And he basically described the wife that he said he was just so much in love with. He said Jill embodied everything he could ever ask for in a partner. She was his love, his best friend and his entire world. And that was all stolen from him on September 22nd. And in place he was given a lifetime of fear, insomnia, unending panic attacks and an anger he never wanted, along with a first-hand knowledge of how deeply depraved and disgusting a human being could be. He said he now has nightmarish and intrusive visions which are constant, that he can't escape whether in sleeping or waking hours. He couldn't help but think what had happened to Jill and think about the waste of her brilliant mind and beautiful soul at the hands of what he said was a grotesque and soulless human being. He described how normally when he went through a bad patch, Jill was the one whose passion, intelligence and strength got him through. But at this, the worst time of his life, she was no longer there. that he thought of her every second of every day and is only half a person now. And he spoke about how his own life has been changed, how he had to move out of the apartment that they shared together because it was so near to where she was killed, and where he's living now, he can barely leave it for fear of panic attacks. And he just wished he had been able to tell Jill that he loved her in her few final moments. Jill's father, George McKeown, was in court as well, and he actually delivered his own victim statement himself personally. And he began by saying, "In our family, we call her Gillian, not Jill." And then he said very calmly, "It's just not okay to rape and kill my child. That's an absolute." He delivered a very moving victim impact statement, and he broke down in tears at times. He described how he had had a stroke in September just before Jill was murdered, and she'd come over to visit him in Perth, and she made him promise that he had to live because she wanted a young and fit granddad for her children. And he spoke today of those grandchildren that will never come, that Jill had hoped to be pregnant by now, but that that obviously wouldn't happen now, and this brutal action that had happened to her would stay with him forever. Jill's mother, Edith, the court heard, was too ill to travel from Perth to Melbourne. And again, her victim impact statement was read to the court. She described how she wasn't sleeping, how she had anxiety and panic attacks, that she felt battered and bruised by what happened. She described how the family had moved to Australia from Ireland in 1990, not by choice as many people, or not by necessity as many people are doing now, but rather by choice, enticed by the adventures that a great country had to offer them. And she described the great times that they had had in Australia and how all of that was ruined because they had come to Australia as a family of four, herself, her husband Jill, and Jill's brother Michael, and they would never leave Australia as a family now that Jill was gone. She said she has recurring nightmares of the terror that her daughter Jill must have suffered in her final moments, and she can't stop thinking about what would have happened to her at that time. There was also a short statement read on behalf of Jill's brother Michael. Very short, he said he really had no words to describe the brutal loss of his sister, that they had lived their life together, grown up together, and now he was in such dreadful pain. Victim impact statements were also delivered on behalf of one of Jill's best friends and also on behalf of her work colleagues in ABC local radio in Melbourne, where they described just the sense of inconsolable loss, of walking past her empty desk in the radio station, of not knowing what to do with themselves. And just the common theme, I suppose, running through everyone's victim impact statements was what a lovely person Jill was, what a great spirit and soul she had, and how vibrant and excited she was about life. And I suppose the gaping hole that all of those people feel is now in their lives.
Okay, Katrina Purry in Melbourne, thank you for that. More from Katrina online and on television news.
Time for the sport from Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Cathal. The British and Irish Lions continue their build-up to the first test against Australia with a game against a Queensland and New South Wales country combined 15 this morning. Simon Zeebo has joined up with the squad in Sydney and he will attend the game today. He should see some action against the Waratahs at the weekend. Rob Kearney has also returned to training and he too expects to play at the weekend.
I'm really happy, I suppose, from where I was 2 weeks ago. There was a lot of uncertainty, you know, as to whether, you know, I get to play again, if I was hanging around, if I'd make the trip to Australia. So, you know, things have improved a huge amount, come through that session, and in contention now, hopefully, to get some time at the weekend. It has been difficult, but it's important just, I suppose, to stay focused and to do all your hard work with the medics who've been really fantastic for me, and they've helped me out a huge amount. And, you know, I probably wouldn't be in contention for the weekend without them.
Yeah, good luck to him. The combined countryside will be the weakest opposition the Lions will face on this tour. The Lions team includes Brian O'Driscoll, Conor Murray, Sean O'Brien and Jamie Heaslip. Rory Best is on the bench. Our rugby commentator Michael Corcoran feels Warren Gatland knows nine of a starting test team at this stage and believes today's game is a good chance to impress.
Well, there's no doubt it's going to be a tough and physical game, certainly for the opening 20 or 25 minutes. That's the pattern of what we've seen so far. You would, however, expect that the Lions will be too strong. I mean, the local team have one player from New South Wales country, eight Super 15 players, two from Queensland country, and four players who play in the Premier Division competition in Sydney. So you would expect that the quality of the Lions will be too good. The weather could play a part. Rain is expected, and it's going to be cold also. Now, in relation to the test team, I think that there's still quite a lot up for grabs. I think Warren Gatland will have penciled in the names of Richard Hibbert, Adam Jones, Paul O'Connell, Jamie Heaslip, Mike Phillips, Johnny Sexton, Jamie Roberts, Lee Halfpenny and George North. That's nine in total of his 15 for the opening test game. So that means that there are six places up for grabs. So quite a lot of deciding and impressing to be done over the next couple of games.
And Michael will have commentary of that game this morning. It gets underway at 10:40. It's live on Radio 1, Longwave 252 and across our digital platforms. The Republic of Ireland plays Spain in New York in the early hours of tomorrow morning. The Irish manager, Giovanni Trapattoni, has announced his team for the game at Yankee Stadium. David Ford starts in goal. The back four is Paul McShane, Sean St. Ledger, Darren O'Dea, and Stephen Kelly. Seamus Coleman switches to midfield. He'll play alongside Jeff Hendrick, who starts his first Irish game. James McCarthy and Andy Keogh also in there. And up front is Robbie Keane and Conor Salmon. The Irish skipper says his side will not be parking the bus against the world and European champions.
Well, I think if you look at the lineup that we have, it's not certainly a defensive lineup by any means. Against these kind of teams, it's usually people play, you know, six in the middle of the park and park the bus, if you like. So, but we're going the usual 4-4-2. So we'll certainly have a go. We know it's going to be a tough game because they're the best team, you know, that I've ever seen. So, but there's no reason why we can't, you know, get a good result. You know, a team is as good as Spain, and it's always good to watch a team like Spain play, but when you play against them, it's as we've seen the Euros, it's very, very difficult because the way they play, they very, very simple but very effective, obviously. So for me, they're the best team that I've seen for a long time. So but it's a good test, good for the young players to experience playing against these players and see how good they are from, you know, from fairly close. But and we're here to, you know, win the game also. It's for them, it's obviously probably more important because they're getting ready for the Confederations Cup. But, you know, for us, it's a good test for the younger players.
Yeah, it should be a good test. All right, the game gets underway at 1 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. The action this evening is in the Irish team's World Cup qualifying group. It's Sweden against the Faroe Islands. One game last night in the Electricity League. Dundalk beat Drogheda 1-0. Patrick Hoban's goal separated the sides. Afterwards, Sean Perry spoke to the Dundalk manager, Stephen Kenny.
Drogheda threw everything at us and we were good on the counter-attack and we had a few chances. It didn't come. But eventually Patrick Hoban got a great goal and we're delighted to win the game.
I suppose the one sour note from your perspective, the dismissal of John Mountney with 7 minutes remaining.
Yeah, very disappointed with that. Like, for simulation, he was clipped in the box. So it was just, you know, it's one of those things that he'll miss the St. Patrick's Athletic game on Friday now, which is a huge blow for us. You know, because that's a big game for us now where we are. We have to think ambitiously.
Tiger Woods and Sergio Garcia have shaken hands at the practice range at Merion Golf Club ahead of the US Open this week. It's the first time the players have met since Garcia's fried chicken comments last month. The US Open has gotten off to a wet start. As much as 5 inches of rain have soaked the course over the last 4 days. Yesterday's practice had to be postponed. More than 100 volunteers have been drafted in to help the groundskeepers get the course ready for Thursday's first round. But former winner Ernie Els is fearing the worst ahead of Thursday.
After the rain this morning, it's going to be very sloppy now. So you're not going to see a firm US Open this year. I'm sorry. You know, I don't care if they get helicopters flying over these fairways. It's not going to dry up.
And not sounding good. Dan Martin will go into today's stage of the Tour of Switzerland in 7th place overall. He's a minute and 23 seconds off the lead held by Matthias Frank. Nicholas Roach 20th. Finally, racing this evening in Roscommon. The action gets underway at 5:15.
Form Commission is to issue a report today on mandatory sentences. It wants the mandatory sentence for murder to be retained but wants judges to have the ability to recommend a minimum term to be served by offenders. The report is also raising issues about drug sentencing. We say good morning now to Tom O'Malley, who's a law lecturer at NUIG and a member of the Law Reform Commission, who's in our Galway studio. Tom O'Malley, why is the Commission recommending minimum term options for murder sentencing in particular?
Well, first of all, there was there were two views on the commission. The minority view, of which I was part, was that the mandatory life sentence of murder should be abolished completely, and that it should be replaced with, if you like, a determinate sentence in each case, or to have that possibility. However, the majority of the commission felt that the life sentence should be retained because of the unique gravity of murder. But it also, of course, accepted that some murders can be more grave than others because of the attendant circumstances. The problem at the present time is that, in effect, it is the executive branch of government rather than the judiciary that, if you like, determines the real sentence for murder, because all the judge can do as soon as there has been a verdict is to impose the life sentence, and it's up to the government to decide when, if ever, the person should be released and how long the person should actually serve in prison. And that's really not very compatible with modern, if you like, constitutional and human rights norms, the idea being that the under which we believe nowadays the term of imprisonment or the punishment that a person should serve for any offence should be judicially decided rather than be decided by, if you like, the political branches of government. So for that reason, I think the recommendation that has been that we have arrived at, or that a majority has arrived at, is a reasonable one, which is that the judges from now on would be in a position to recommend the minimum term of imprisonment that a person would serve on conviction for murder. And then in addition to that, and this is very important as part of our overall recommendations, that there would be a statutory parole board that would decide on an independent basis when, in fact, the person was eligible or safe to be released, having regard to any risk that they might pose.
And the government has committed to putting the parole board on a statutory footing. But this issue of guidelines and the whole difficulty about it, no, you wrote about it, I think, in the Irish Times earlier in the year. And if I recall correctly, Mr. Justice Peter Charlton raised it in the Martin Tansey Memorial Lecture sometime earlier this year, and we discussed it here on the programme. This issue of guidelines and the Judicial Council sitting down to publish a set of guidelines for sentencing, it's also part of your recommendation. How important is that?
Well, it is part of an overall package, if you like. In relation to guidelines, there is a big debate to be had about that. The debate has been going on for many years, much longer than the episodes that you suggested. It must be remembered that there are many different kinds of guidelines. There would be very little appetite on this side of the Atlantic for the kind of very rigorous guidelines that they have, for example, in parts of the United States. They have different kinds of guidelines still in Britain, for example. The vast majority of countries, as it happens throughout the world, have a discretionary sentencing system like our own. So when we talk about guidelines, therefore, we're talking more about what I would call guidance. That is to say that there would be more guidance available to trial judges at all of the courts as to the appropriate levels of punishment that are merited for particular offences, bearing in mind that there will always be exceptional circumstances which would justify a departure from those guidelines or benchmarks. However, I suppose it's true to say that in this country, historically, we haven't really had the information levels and the data and so forth that would have permitted us to develop guidance of that nature. That kind of information is now beginning to be collected and to be analysed. So we would hope that over a period of years, and especially if there is a Judicial Council established by statute, that as part of its remit, that it might begin the process of developing guidance and guidelines of different sentencing guidance, let's put it that way, of different kinds. And hopefully then that would be as a quid pro quo for abolishing most of the mandatory sentences that we have, which really don't make a lot of sense, especially in relation to drugs and firearms.
Yeah, and on the drugs one in particular, because there has been some considerable attention paid to it this morning. You're saying in your report, am I right, that it is your view that people involved in the drugs trade are effectively adapting to the current law and the current sentencing regime. What is happening and what can be done to resolve it?
Well, there's no doubt about it that drugs crimes can be very serious, just as firearms offences can be very serious. But the problem at the present time is that we have a law that goes back to 1999, whereby if a person is caught in possession of drugs to the value of €13,000 or more, and that really hasn't changed over a decade or more, that figure, that person must be given a sentence of 10 years imprisonment at least, although the judge does, in certain circumstances, have the discretion to depart downwards. Now, there are a number of problems with that particular arrangement. First of all, it's not entirely clear why drugs should be singled out for that kind of special treatment when there are other serious offences that are not. But more importantly, just focusing on drugs itself, there is the difficulty as to why, or there is the puzzle as to why one particular feature of the offence, namely the happenstance that the drugs are worth €13,000 or more, why that particular factor should trigger a person's eligibility for a 10-year sentence, when in fact there are far more important issues to be taken into account for sentencing purposes, such as the level of involvement that the person had in the overall criminal enterprise. Because very often what happens is that the person who's actually caught with the drugs and the person who ends up getting sentenced may be somebody who didn't make any financial gain out of the transaction at all. They may have been just a drugs courier.
Okay, Tom O'Malley, member of the Law Reform Commission, thank you for speaking to us from Galway this morning. It's almost 12 minutes to nine.
During an interview with Transport Minister Leo Varadkar early in the programme, I said there was no such thing as a return flight on Ryanair. That wasn't accurate, as the minister pointed out, and as the airline's website makes clear, and as I'm doing now. Research in Britain has raised questions about breast cancer screening programmes. This is research carried out by the Department of Public Health at the University of Oxford, published in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, which states that there is no evidence of an effect of mammographic screening on breast cancer mortality at population level. Now, that's sort of the headline, as the researchers put it. Somebody who knows a lot more about this is Professor Arnie Hill, consultant breast surgeon at Beaumont Hospital, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Colin.
And thanks for taking the call. What's your reading of the questions and the doubts this raises about the effectiveness of breast screening programmes at national levels?
Well, I think the first thing to point out, Colin, that this journal is a particularly low impact factor journal. It wouldn't be very high up in the prestigious journals that we would recognise. Having said that, there's a lot of good news in the paper. It looks at 40 years of breast cancer treatment in the UK, and it confirms the ongoing decrease in breast cancer mortality, which is a very positive thing. What they do find in the paper is they try to isolate those patients that have been screened and see whether their reduction in mortality is greater than those who weren't screened, and they haven't been able to show that. And the probable reason is that there are many other factors that have improved the outcome from breast cancer treatment. For instance, it's over a long time period, just 40 years of treatment there. We've had drugs such as tamoxifen, which individually have had a very strong effect on breast cancer survival. There's been better organized care. And more recently, we've had more innovative treatments, such as targeted therapies. And there's probably been a greater awareness and earlier diagnosis. So it's over a very long time period. I'm not surprised that it hasn't been able to isolate a particular group who had screening to say they had a significant decrease in mortality greater than the average. It is a topical subject at the moment, but I don't think it causes any concerns or worries about the value of screening.
Are you basically saying that this research is pointing to an absence of evidence for the effectiveness of breast screening rather than the presence of evidence which says it is not effective?
No, I think the study is somewhat flawed in that it's looking at too large a population over a very long period of time. I don't think they've been specific enough and been able to ask the question about the benefit of mammographic screening in this population. I think the study is flawed in a number of ways. Firstly, that it's over 40 years, and the data collection from 40 years ago wouldn't be as good as it is now. So it's very difficult to make strong conclusions, such as the statement. And they're very careful in their article. They don't do away with the concept that breast cancer screening is good. They just caution and say, this didn't show the effect that it might
have. BreastCheck have said in a statement they're going to review these findings, but they point to an independent breast screening review for the UK, which was published last year, that breast screening, which showed that breast screening does save lives. They say they aim to detect breast cancer at the earliest stage when a woman has greater treatment options and her chosen treatment is likely to be less extensive. And they're encouraging women to make an informed decision and advise them to look at breastcheck.ie for more. Is that broadly the attitude you would take?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think there was a very comprehensive review 2 years ago in the UK, which did say there is a benefit to screening and mammography. And I think everyone should be encouraged to participate in the National Breast Screening Programme when it is available to them.
All right, Professor, thank you very much. That's Professor Arnie Hill of Beaumont. Minute to nine.